Det enda som krävs för att ondskan ska segra är att goda män inte gör någonting.
Radio Mises, avsnitt 91. Idag har vi David Dyrr med oss och Joakim Fagerström. Och vi ska tala om... Ja, god dagens. Hello David.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Vi ska tala idag om privat lag och lite andra idéer som David har. Han är från Schweiz och är professor i juridik. Jag ska låta honom introducera sig här. So David, welcome to our show today. You are a professor of law in Switzerland.
Yes, that's right. I'm professor of law in Switzerland for many years already. I'm not the youngest anymore. So I'm lawyer since 40 years and professor of law since 25 years. In a way, quite a conventional career. I studied law in Switzerland and in Harvard Law School about 40 years ago. And that was in the beginning quite a conventional education, and I started practicing law then, but I always kept the academic interest or the theoretical interest. And this is the reason why then I went to university some years later. And so I always combined practice of law on the one side and theory and, you know, fundamental thinking about law on the other side.
What university are you associated with?
I am now professor of law at Zurich University. I live in Basel, which is another place in Switzerland, and my practice is in Basel and Zurich. But my academic position, my professorship, so to speak, is in Zurich.
I see. What was your specialty as a lawyer, and even, yeah, what was your field?
My field in practice is... It's business oriented. I am lawyer and, which is something in Switzerland quite important, I am also notary public. I know in other countries, in the United States, this means nothing, but in this European continental system, the notary is the specialist in contracts, in real estate matters and things like that. So this is about the field or the core of my activity, corporation, real estate, but also litigation. Not only, you know, contracts and structures, but also litigation before courts, state courts and arbitration courts. So this is my practical field. And what my academic field is concerned, it's on the one side also these matters, private law, we call it, and theory of law. And theory of law, this is, you can also say, philosophy of law. It's fundamental thinking about law. So it's this combination I'm dealing with at university.
I think law is a topic that has been neglected a little bit by people in the freedom movements.
That's true. Yes.
Usually say that, you know, many people say that, well, we should privatize the post office and healthcare and things like that. But we will wait with law until the end. That will be the last one. But I usually say that's the one we should privatize first. What do you say?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Yes, it's. You can also say that the monopoly, which is Fundamentally, when we will discuss these things, it's always, I think, the monopoly, which is the big problem. So the monopoly of, what did you say, postal service and healthcare and education and things like that. Of course, they are bad and inefficient and not justified, but the most dangerous one is the monopoly of justice, of you know, official coercion.
Yeah.
Of the law, you can say. I think this is the most dangerous monopoly, the most unuseful, the most unnecessary monopoly. And you're right. A lot of classical liberals say, even they say you must maintain that monopoly, or they would say you have to privatize last. And with you, I would say you have to privatize first.
Yeah. So before we go into details, which I'm looking forward to, Joachim, it was your suggestion that we bring Professor Dürr onto the show. How did you meet?
Yes, first time I listened to David was in Bodrum, Turkey, last year, 2015. Where he had a very interesting talk. I think the name was something like Private Law Society, answering some of the difficult questions. And now recently in September, the second time we met, David talked about on how to take the state to court. Both very interesting speeches, and they were very popular speeches at this conference. That started up, I think, many discussions, since, as you said, Klaus, this about private law, many freedom-oriented people, it's a very interesting subject. And also, if you look at this classical liberal, as you say, they want to keep this monopoly many times. So that's why I think it was very interesting to have Professor Dürr here on the show. And also, I think it's quite interesting. Maybe you can tell us a bit about that, David, when you contacted Professor Hoppe the first time. Hoppe talked about this during the conference when he introduced you last time. I think that story is quite interesting.
That's interesting. Actually, I do not know him for a long time already. It's a few years ago. Of course, I knew some of his writings, but actually not very in detail. But then some years ago, when I met these books and articles of Hans Hoppe, I was quite delighted to read things that are precisely the way I thought. That I, developed in discussions, in seminars and things like that, when I found that there were really big contradictions in our state-oriented law system. And then I asked, is there nobody around thinking like me? And it's really quite difficult to find people. But then I found these books and articles of Hans Hoppe, and I was astonished. That's precisely what I think too. And so then I took contact with him, and since then we are exchanging ideas and working together and meeting at this conference. And I think that's could be and could become an even more intensive partnership.
Anything special that you read from him that impressed you?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of quite good short articles. You can read, I think, all of them on the Mises website, namely on private law society, the subject we are going to discuss later. But of course, many pieces of his big work. So there's. It's more a collection, the book Democracy, The God That Failed, I think was the title. And these are really impressive writings that I liked very much. And you're right, what is a bit maybe special, what my person is concerned, is that I, as a lawyer, think like, for instance, Hans Hoppe, who is a philosopher, or philosopher and economist. And there are a lot of, you know, sociologists and anthropologists and in any way, you know, people that are not lawyers that may be ready to accept the system of anarchism, but you almost never find a lawyer who supports this attitude or this way of thinking. Usually, when the lawyers come in, they say it would be fine to have a, you know, completely free anarchistic system, but unfortunately, it's not possible with the law. This is what usually lawyers say, but I wouldn't say so. So this is maybe a bit special what my profession is concerned.
It's the roads and the laws are very special in people's minds.
Yeah. And also, Professor Hoppe told us that you had written a book as well, more that he tried to read, but it was too complicated for him, he said. Can you tell us a bit about the book?
Well, maybe that was my, we call it habilitation.
Yes.
We have this system in continental Europe. Maybe it's the same in Sweden, I do not know. Once you want to make an academic career or to become a professor at university, you have to write maybe a certain collection of articles or a book, you know, which is the habilitation condition, so to speak. And this was maybe a relatively theoretical work, asking what is the basis to legitimize legal influence in subjects that are not only, you know, a difference between two people, but very fundamental differences on the level of society as a whole. So conflicts over individual conflicts, what is the basis to influence then by law, and what is the legitimation that law can influence, stop this behavior or encourage another behavior. That was the subject. And the I would say that the center of the outcome of it for me in this book was that conflicts must be solved and answered and influenced by themselves. There are no rules outside that must be implemented from the above, so to speak, you know, down into this bad world. But the rules are there already. They come out of the conflict. And of course, that was a theoretical subject of that book. And of course, if you develop this more and more, then you get a fundamental problem with this system of state law, where in principle that law is implemented like from outside of this world, you know, from above, from heaven or from the castle or so, down to this world. And I think this, I thought there already, and was then more and more more convinced afterwards that this is a sort of fundamental mistake in our system we have.
Interesting. As you said, there are many ways for people to start thinking about freedom. For myself, I came in through thinking about economics. What was your path, Joachim?
I think the philosophy side of things, what you can do and not do, and why should the state be able to do certain things which we cannot do. So that was my path. It was not the economic path, and not the private law part to start with. So I think that was the last part that I abandoned. First, it was the post office, the roads, and so on. Then the final straw, I guess, was when I read Democracy, the God That Failed, by Hans Hermann Hoppe, and you have about the private law society as well. So it took a while for me to come to that conclusion. So I started on the opposite end.
Like moral philosophy.
I think there are always many aspects also of this theme, this subject. You can say it's a question of efficiency or of acceptance by many, but also a question of justification.
So tell us about the evolution of your thoughts. When did you start thinking about these ideas? And what did you, what was it like when you came to the conclusion?
Actually, there was no, you know, dramatic event when I realized that from this day on the world is different for me. So the Damascus, when Saulus changed to Paulus, you know, mm-hmm. nothing like that happened to me. I just kept my interest into these questions since the studies, mainly those studies I had at Harvard Law School in jurisprudence and theory of law, and parallel to my practice, I always, you know, kept contact to these questions, and of course within, you know, my seminars and in my lectures in theory of law, or in, you know, hermeneutic, things like that, I more and more realized that there are fundamental contradictions in this system. That once I teach the law and I tell the students that the basis for law are these statutes rendered by some organizations called parliament, things like that. And then, you know, thinking further that they make quite different law in case these laws are for themselves or they are for normal people, things like that. So I think it was just an evolution of trying to remain consequent in thinking. And then from a certain time on, it was quite clear that it's bluntly wrong, this system. And then I became telling this to the students. But it was not, you know, once overnight. It was a certain development. And I would say once you really keep thinking, consequently thinking in these matters, I would say there is no other outcome than this one, than the anarchistic outcome. Only by this you are able to exclude these contradictions you have in this traditional system.
So what do your students say, and what do people in your at the university say, other faculty members, about these ideas?
I think that the biggest problem, so to speak, or my problem with this is that there is no scandal. That they, you know, a lot of students are very, very, you know, decent, nice young people that go to university in order to learn what is. They are not interested in what should be or what should be different. They want to learn what is. This is what they learn for the exam, and then they have their diploma and can work in this job. To a certain extent, I understand that, because before, you know, ask or questioning something fundamentally, you have to know it. And so maybe the beginners, they have first to learn how the system works, this system, this traditional system, and only the next step, of course, or maybe they are able to question it, to ask fundamental questions and to to find contradictions. Maybe that of course then is a second step. But even in seminars, let's say these are not seminars for the very beginners, these are seminars for students that are in their third or fourth year of the studies. Even there, I would say the bigger part is not very, catched by these ideas. They, of course, they make their papers and everything. And of course, I encourage them to take different positions, of course, that we can discuss it. But there are some, I would say, some few that are very interested, and they come to me and say, oh, that would be interesting subject for some thesis, or how can we develop it? And so I do have some contacts with students that are very close to this way of thinking, of former students. Now they are journalists or so, and I keep some contacts with them still. But in general, the reaction is not the big scandal. And also what my colleagues, other professors, is concerned, they are usually nice people, and they think, oh, that's interesting, what you're telling here, and yes, why not to think like that? But after discussion, they go, home to their office and to their way of thinking. There are some, two or three, I would say, that became more interested through my contacts.
But do they have any problems with the inherent contradictions of state law like you do? Or they just accept them?
Yes, or maybe there is another point. In the academic world, there are a lot of pure theorists. They are glad to think intelligent things and to read and write elegant books and to be brilliant, but they have not the intention to change the world or the law system, not to be big, and therefore I think there are quite a lot of colleagues that they have sympathy with it. Maybe they would not, go ahead now writing different articles or articles in this anarchistic system, but for them it's not a wish to influence it in a better direction. This is maybe one problem what the academia is concerned. Another one, of course, is that they do not want to think differently because they live off this system, or sometimes even that they cannot think different from their conventional way, because once you are in a system of thinking during tens of years, then it's sometimes not quite simple to change that. And to admit that for 20 or 30 years you were on the wrong side, this maybe is one of the problems too.
How long have you called yourself an anarchist? Or I don't know if you call yourself that, but how long have you been had these strong views?
I am anarchist. This is not that long anymore. Not that long yet. It's about, I would say, for the last 10 or 15 years. I would say, actually, my way of thinking, to be frank, this is nothing but anarchism, which is something, when I wrote my habilitation work I mentioned before, I would not have called myself at all anarchist. But not I think because my way of thinking was still different, but because I didn't realize yet that this is anarchism. Anarchism, of course, you have to define it, and I define it, let's say, close to the notion Ache, which is a Greek word, which means not order. So anarchy is not an order. Ache means actually first or firstness, beginning, things like that. And then in a more transformed sense, it means the something single, the only. In the word archduke or archbishop, you have this same word arche, which means this is the very first, the very only, the very highest duke. You know, this is the archduke. And so arche is the highest, the one and only. And anarche means just without an instance that is one and only. You have instances, many instances of perhaps you have you know, centers of power and whatever in a society exists, but none of all these has the right to pretend that he is the highest and the only and the prince, you know. And this is anarchy. This is a system of order, or you can understand it as a system of order, but a specifically decentralized order and not a monopolized order. This is anarchy. And so this notion for myself, anarchist, I use it maybe for 10 or 12 or 15 years.
So you mentioned some inherent contradictions in state law, for example, that the rules are different for the rulers than for the ruled. That is a contradiction. Any other contradictions in this system?
Yes, there is one very fundamental contradiction, namely what the law in a very specific and technical sense is concerned. It is once there is a conflict, it's a fundamental principle of legal procedure that some independent, unbiased third should help to solve this problem. The judge must be independent from both parties. And even if there is a slight suspicion that he could depend from one of the parties, he is unable to take that responsibility. And now this fundamental principle is violated fundamentally in the state system, because all differences you have with the state are judged by state courts. So one of the two parties is the judge. So these judges are on the payroll of one of the two parties, which is astonishing, huh? not to say ridiculous or a scandal, but this is the case, and this is what, you know, conventional law professors teach their students, that in such a case you go to the court, and this court is a state court, and they take the notes and learn it for the exam, and then and they believe that they do not think about this contradiction. Of course, there are some excuses then, once you raise this question, and the main excuse is called separation of power. But it's really just a silly excuse. And if anybody else would bring this excuse, everybody would laugh at them. If you have a litigation against a big company, a bank or so, because they ruined your fortune, and then you want to sue this bank before a court, and then the bank says, okay, that's fine, we agree to go to a court, but we, the bank, we are the court, and then then you're surprised, and the bank says, but you know, we have a separation of power. That department of ours, which is the court, is somehow separated from the other departments. You would laugh at them again. But if it's the state, with this ridiculous excuse, everybody reacts quite seriously and think, oh, that's something very important. The high principle, you know, of the rule of law, that there is a separation of power. But it's a ridiculous excuse.
Well, if you take the state to court, your chances are not that great. So it doesn't seem to be working.
That's true. If you want, I mean, this then is the outcome. If you really would, let's say we can make the test, and why not to sue the state before a state court for his stateness? You blame the state that he is the state with all these terrible attributes of taxation, of forcing people to obey to his legislation and things like that. And now you sue the state before a state court for all these crimes. And let's assume I really try then to argue before that court that this first gang, so to speak, in our country, that this first gang violates the law by taxing me, by taking money away from me without my consent and without me having used anything of the state, just because I have the money, they take it away and say this is taxation. So these crimes, I blame this first gang in our country before that state court. They would laugh at me. Maybe they think now this is really, this professor is too old. In the meantime, he doesn't think clearly anymore. Or in the best case, they would say, that's an interesting question, Mr. Attorney at law. An interesting question indeed. We should think about that more deeply. But, you know, for this very procedure here, it's not the subject. I'm sorry. We have to decide this according to the laws that are the basis of our system, which are the state laws, and therefore, I'm sorry, I have to reject your action. This would be the reaction, and therefore, I am thinking about other ways of taking the state to the court.
So you are thinking about these things. Have you done anything about it, or has it been mostly theoretical? So far,
for the time being, it's still a theoretical preparation, so to speak. But in order not to make the same mistake that all other professors make as well, just to think about it and not to do something, you know, I really want to then realize it. So the idea is this, that we are going to make a lawsuit against the state here in Switzerland. Actually, this is the state I know. Other states, I do not know them closer. And in Switzerland, we have many states. In a way, it's an advantage on the fundamental level, because we do not have just one state. So this monopolistic principle is not that strong in Switzerland than in other more centralized states like France or so, with Paris, which is the state. We do have our central state, which is domiciled in Bern, but actually in Switzerland we have 26 other or further small states as well, the cantons, sort of provinces, but they are quite not independent, but these are states with a certain power, so also with a certain power against the central state. But nevertheless, I would pick out now of these 27 states the central one, this Swiss Confederation, how it's called, and say you are not the Swiss Confederation, which sounds very nice, you know, this sounds a bit like you are the incorporation of all people in this country, which is of course not the case. It's just, as I called it before, the first gang of 40,000 people, about a middle-sized firm domiciled in Bern, but they pretend to represent everybody in our country. And this is the defendant I would like to sue by a legal process. So I pick out of these 27 this one, the Swiss Confederation, and file a class action against it. I am looking for people who won't follow me as plaintiffs. It would be nice to find 50,000 plaintiffs, because that would be a bigger number than those 40,000 the first gang consists of. And then these 50,000 people could file a class action against that organization, claiming that they must be released from their mandatory membership or from their mandatory submission to this organization, that they are released from taxation, that they are released from obeying all these many legislations rendered by the central state. We will very much insist on only these plaintiffs must be released. If anybody else wants to remain member of that organization, of course, we do not want to hinder them. We do not want to abolish that organization, but we want to force it to release the plaintiffs out of the mandatory membership. That would be the idea. And now, of course, you will ask, what court shall decide this?
Mm-hmm.
And this is quite a tricky question, because certainly not the federal court that exists. There is a federal court beside the cantonal court in Switzerland. We have also a federal court, certainly not with him. But we have to find, you know, other third instances, independent instances. And now this is maybe an aspect of natural law. We maybe will come in discussion to that point too, you know, once you ask me what law is applicable.
Yes, exactly. What is the legal basis for this lawsuit?
If you sue the state, who usually is the lawmaker, you do not accept the state law, but you refer to other laws to be applied on this case. And the same is, what is the instance to decide on this conflict? When I say it's not necessary that the state makes law, this is because laws are there. Law are in society as a natural phenomenon of mutual behavior of the Homo sapiens in society. This is the reason why we react when other people attack us or try to take things away that we are the owner of. Out of these natural phenomenons, you do not have only reactions to such aggressions, but also reaction of bystanders of society that come together, that shout around, that blame those people. Again, reaction on this, that all these reactions should be in a, you know, reliable way, not too explosive, but not too calm. to, you know, in a professional and organized way. All this comes out of national natural reactions. And therefore, I think it's a process like this which defines the way we argue and which defines, you know, the reaction that it provokes, be it in the media, be it that we will find some independent arbitrator, or that some procedure takes place that has some mediating effect, things like that. So actually it's quite open, but on a fundamental basis, this is law. This is how law works, how reactions are organized and in a civilized way developed in order to cope with aggressivity like the one being made by this first gang called Swiss Confederation.
That is a nice theory, but still we need to find a court that the state is accepting and some legal basis for this lawsuit to be meaningful, right?
Yeah. I would say yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. And you know, I try to remain realistic, even though we would find a court and a court, you know, against resistance of Swiss Confederation, they would not agree voluntarily to some arbitration procedure, I would think. And within our system, an arbitration court is not binding on them without their consent. A state law could be competent, but we do not want to go to the state law, state court. So this problem, or this step maybe, is open for the moment, but I think the more important step is that once such a judgment is rendered, you have to enforce it. And I think that is the most difficult step then, because the power is with the state. And I think that an effect that such a lawsuit or such a legal claim is then really realized, that this only happens because it's a very general problem you are working with here. It only happens if it happens, you know. It does not happen that the state withdraws from his arrogant attitude because some strong player orders that he does so. But he would withdraw only if this is the real effect, if history goes in that direction. If there is a tendency that history goes in that direction, does that this centralizing tendency is weakened and maybe goes will be destroyed somewhere, then it's because this is a tendency in the societal development, maybe for economic reasons also, that these economic systems of the state are not strong enough to hold on longer. So I would say if we really succeed in changing the world in that anarchistic direction, then it's not because we have done it, but because afterwards, so to speak, we can say, oh, look back, the history of mankind wasn't that bad, not as bad as we thought first it could develop. Finally, it took some change in direction and developed to a more decentralized structure. And only if one can say that, you know, afterwards, so to speak, by looking back, then we can also say perhaps the it was worthwhile to accompany this tendency by giving the arguments and maybe by influencing the way of thinking by people that it's not necessary to have some fixed monopoly somewhere, but that the world is much better if there is no such central monopoly. Maybe it's that way, you know, to cope with these fundamental questions.
And also, David, as you, I think you said when we met last time, even if this would fail to take the state to court, you would get a lot of attention and maybe start a real debate, and more people would open their eyes to see that, to listen, they have to take it seriously and see what this is about.
Yeah. Yes, that of course is a level, so to speak, in this plan as well, that even though it's not possible to have a judgment, you could at least initiate a certain debate, yes, and the certain attentiveness of people to these questions. And in Switzerland, by the way, I think we really have the advantage that people maybe generally are quite interested in politics. We are so-called direct democracy, which is not true actually, but sometimes we have these votes, these referendums, not only elections. So there is a certain political attitude, let's say, of people, and therefore it's not completely unrealistic to provoke such a maybe change of thinking. And we have also some speciality, I think, in Switzerland. These 26 states I mentioned before, these cantons, they are in fact relatively strong organizations. And I could imagine, which is not completely unrealistic, that at least the central state could be, you know, overruled and abolished for economic reasons, but also for political reasons. So that such a debate as the one you also mentioning could have some influence on, you know, on a result that this central state gets problems. And therefore, this lawsuit, this blame, this organized class blame against the state is not against these 26 players. And perhaps in Switzerland, one can say once the central state is overruled, there are still 26 other states, but there are 26 and not one. And this gives a certain chance that they get in a certain mutual competition, that they do not understand themselves that much as they did before as states, but more than, you know, enterprises, centers of services that are not necessarily that monopolized any more than they used to be. So all this could perhaps influence a certain development in Switzerland. And I could imagine that by such developments, the fundamental, precise legal questions perhaps do not have to decide it formally anymore. That it's the development as such that, you know, gives right to this class action.
I assume the number of people you get on board on your class action would be important. If you come alone against the state, then, I mean, the state is run by feelings too. So if there's a lot of people, then it has a bigger impact.
So this is my plan. My idea is just it's not much more than an idea. I'm writing on a concept. I talked about it with many people. So the list that I have of people that they promised they would come with me for this class action, it's not yet 50,000. It's below 1,000. But still, there are some that are already quite interested. And of course, this too, the collection of these plaintiffs must be organized.
I'm not legally trained, but I'm interested and curious. So I've read some. And one of the things I've read is the Swedish, I wouldn't call it the constitution. It's Grundlag, Grundgesetz, or whatever you would say in German. And it is one of the most ridiculous documents I have ever read. Because it's so full of contradictions and nonsense that I have no idea how they would even use that legally. I usually say that the best part of the Swedish Grundlag is the part that talks about the order of succession of the royalty, because it's short and it's simple and it's free from contradictions, but the rest is a joke.
Well, I think this is typical for so-called constitutions. But what do you say? I didn't know that. Secession from the
no,
king?
No, no, the succession of...
Succession. Okay, I see.
Swedish Grundlag consists of four parts, and that part is only a couple of pages long, and it's the oldest part of the Swedish
Grundlag. Of course, yeah. The monarchy, yes, I can imagine, yeah.
Just
very much underlined that constitutions are usually very strange documents and with a lot of contradictions. That's true, yes.
When it comes to private law, David, have you been studying any historical examples of, you know, way back how law was practiced? We talk about written law versus more, what should we say, arbitrary law?
Well, I mean, this is a well-known subject in the history of law. And I would say the very general row, so to speak, of the development of our law tradition stemming from Roman law is always accompanied by this question of written law or common law or habitual law. In principle, one can say the law we have as untechnically speaking common law of our European continental tradition is a sort of natural law. This was in principle not, you know, ordered by some authority. It came out of the conflicts of court cases. The Roman praetor, the judge, rendered these judgments and developed theories about these or that constellations, and this in turn was developed by further judgments, this system of precedence, you know, and all this actually coming to our time, then this tradition, it's at least important parts of it are still the same, typically within what we today call private law. And all this actually is also those parts of this private law that came into this national legislations, those codifications in Germany, also Switzerland, France with Napoleon, later Germany, Austria and so on, Italy, all these well-known civil codes, actually they are nothing but that natural law developed through centuries. And of course, science was interested in working with these natural phenomenons. They tried to read it down, to write it down in paragraphs, in restatements, so to speak, like in the United States sometimes it's called, not legislation, but restatement of what is there. And this looks about like a statute, but it's just a writing down of what you see in society, in law practice. And then I think what was the sinfall, so to speak, is that in the 19th century, this newly installed national state thought that he must write in thick books what is the law, and only after he wrote it in these books, it's the law. And I think that's the sinfall that happened, and with this came also this problem of statutory positivism, that lawyers usually only think in written texts. They do not think about what is the meaning of it, what is just or unjust, things like that. They just see some text, and they are really precisely bound to this text, and perhaps they discuss about this or that interpretation of the text and not of the idea behind. I think this too is a problem, of course, rendered by the state, by this national state of the 19th century. And this is the way of thinking. Our traditional law is still in and is very reluctant to go beyond that.
And it's also, I would think, a natural development of having a big central state. Necessarily becomes very bureaucratic and rigid, and
that's a good point, and sometimes for me an embarrassing argument, because you can say, if you insist on natural law, on natural phenomenons, the state is also a natural phenomenon, so why do you blame it? You know, this is an argument not too easy to reply on, but nevertheless, I would then say, but there are also some few anarchists. This also is a natural phenomenon. You and me and all people interested in anarchism and in arguing and thinking like that are also a natural phenomenon.
Yes, we're all part of nature, in a sense.
We are part of nature.
I personally have a problem with written law for this very reason, because it tends to take on a life of itself. I haven't studied this as much as you have, but I think in history it's quite clear that lawyers who work with written law, they become more interested in interpreting text. And you see this, I think, in Roman times. You see it in Jesus' time. He condemns the lawyers for just looking at the letter of the law and making up their own laws. And I see it in our day, where obvious criminals are being, because there's some letter of the law that is not fulfilled, even though it's clear that they're criminals or rapists or whatever. But the state doesn't care about the meaning of the law, just the letter of the law. And this is a problem I have with written law. It takes on a life of itself. Have you seen that too?
I think that this is a consequence out of this attitude that you are fixed on the text. On the other hand, one must admit that there is a certain need to have a need of stability. Everybody finds arguments for his position, and maybe then it's not reliable what would be the outcome. Will this be a judge who really is able and ready to think objectively of this conflict? And therefore, it's not too bad to have some rules you can, you know, take out of the book and cite it and argue with it and maybe it gives you some help against too much arbitrariness of the people that are going to decide. So I would say there is also a need for some technique of stability, and why not to have it in texts? So this as such, I think, is not a bad thing. I think here again, the problem is that all these questions are very difficult questions, and we are far away from, you know, a paradise concept. But here again, I think the problem is the monopolized system. Why should it not be possible that different law systems should be able to compete with each other? And maybe some are better in coping this problem of stability, of reliability. Others are more successful in matters of material justice. Thirds are more successful in speed, other in, you know, not to be too expensive, whatever. I think because there is not one solution, it's very important that you have to enable all this potential of improvement and in differentiation and whatever of legal system, that all this potential is not hindered by a monopoly. And therefore, I'm convinced that once you have different systems, that also this problem of written texts will be much better handled with than it is today.
Yes, so without the monopoly, it wouldn't be such a big problem. That's an interesting point. But in a sense, we already have private law today, because many companies will not resolve their conflicts in a state court. They will go to private arbitrators, right?
That's true, yeah. I mean, this shows that it's not an idea from a foreign world. It happens, and why not to extend it to any other conflicts as well?
Yes.
We talked about the constitution before and the problem with a written constitution. What do you think of, for example, we have new, like Libeland, they tried to create a country in Europe, and they have written a constitution. What do you think about that? Do you see, are there any potential dangers with to start a new country like that?
Well, that I think it's a nice idea, this Libeland. You and me, you met the president.
Yes.
Recently, who is a nice guy. He became father, I think, a couple of months ago. So the prince is born already for the
next
person.
Of course.
To be frank, and I, of course, it's easier said than done, but I was a bit disappointed about this system he presents, because in a way he structures it in a very conventional, I would say, statist way. I think they have even taxes. Of course, he always underlines that these are voluntary taxes, but I'm not so sure about it. So it seems that he wants to install some monopolistic instance in this small country there, maybe a quite liberal monopolistic system, but only one. And I would say, once you have the possibility to create such an experiment of a new social order, so you shouldn't just start with a monopoly. Why not a constitution where you say in two or three sentences, our constitution is that nobody is allowed to claim a monopoly for himself, even though he is called state. Maybe it's only one sentence, which is enough for a constitution.
Yeah, one of the problems is that I think to be recognized as a new country, a new state, you have to create a similar structure, similar to the state. I think it's four different areas that you have to fulfill to be recognized by other embassies. For example, you have to be in control of the area that for the new country, for example, and different stuff. So that, I think that's why they create, for example, they have plans for parliament and so on and so on. I haven't read the constitution yet, but I also see this kind of problems that can easily, very fast, go in the wrong direction.
I see this point that, of course, I did not study all the details. I once had a look at it, not more than this, to be frank. And this aspect of external relation, you're right. This is quite a problem in, you know, within this context here. So I already thought about, you know, such a plan as the one I mentioned before for Switzerland. I could imagine that within such a privatization plan, that something that really comes last is not the law, but is the subject of the external relationships to other countries. Maybe this is some organization that you have to maintain in order to be able to cope with the problem of official relations to other countries. Why not? But then you have to differentiate it quite clearly. This is a purely external coordination, in a way, of the people in this small country, that for external purposes only, they create a certain representation, but only for external purposes, not for internal. Then why not? But I think in this example, it's not that strictly restrained to that purpose.
I can see 100 problems with that as a starting point of another state. Somebody feels that they have the right to represent the people in this free country. And
maybe it's a bit like the problem of the treaty now between Europe and Canada. And it seems that Europe is not enough centralized in order to be able to sign this treaty, because some part of Belgium is against it and it blocks all. Do you know this case now?
No, I don't, but it sounds like
Just you have it in the newspapers. I do not know the details, but I thought it was wonderful. Like, yeah, this small part of a country, it's only the Wallonian part of Belgium, that is against this treaty, and therefore this big treaty is blocked.
That sounds great.
And everybody thinks it's terrible that you cannot make any treaties with Europe anymore, and I would say that's wonderful.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Very good. At the end of this, we will ask you to, if you would, recommend a book to read, so you can think about that for a few minutes. What would a society look like, a private law society, do you think? How would conflicts be resolved, and would it be peaceful? Would everybody be taking the law into their own hands, or?
Such a society, I would say, it doesn't look completely different from the one we know, namely what legal aspects is concerned. There are specialists in conflict solution. They are professionals in deciding conflicts. Maybe some of them call themselves court or arbitration. There are services with well-trained people to enforce judgments in case it's necessary. There are maybe more decentralized structures, how people protect themselves against aggression, things like that. I think also in that private law society. We are not in a paradise where everybody is nice to everybody and correct and things like that. Not at all. But we do not have it in this centralized way. And I think that this law business, so to speak, is much smaller than it is today. Because even though man is not an angel, and even though there is aggressivity and egoism and things like that, he has his good sides. And therefore, I think also the good sides and the conflict solution minded attitudes, all these things, this is a big potential that it's more or less, you know, blocked today. And once all this is activated, I'm convinced that without a big business and without big legal structures, that could be quite a peaceful society. There is law, but on a much smaller level.
So what if I would like to take Joachim to court for some reason? How would he be forced to court? If he may say, no, I'm not interested. How would that be dealt with?
A big part of the answer is contractual basis, maybe in combination, you know, with insurances. Insurance companies do not only offer you payment in case it happens, but also services in order to solve problems you have with other people that caused you damage, things like that. And maybe these insurances, they have contract with such services, of course, not only with one, but with many. So I think there could be complete and big networks of contractual systems that is then the basis of such conflict solutions. And if these are really contractual bases, I think it works, because a contract means that people consented to it. And therefore, there is a good chance that it's also accepted and it's quite stable. Of course, one does not forget that there are always also people that do not sign any contract. It's nice to refer always to contracts, but what shall we do if some do not sign contracts? If they just attack you and then they do not consent to anything, and maybe they are quite strong, things like that. This too is a problem you have to have answers to. And I think that if members of society behave like that, this in turn provokes counter organizations. If he is strong, others would work together to be even stronger. And on the long run, I think all these organizations know that, you know, a forceful conflict is much more expensive than other solutions. So I think on the long run, even people that are not very, you know, ready to sign contracts, with the time they do sign contracts. So the tendency to the war of all against all, as Hobbes once wrote, I think this tendency is not too strong. And because of such effects, of such reaction effects, I think this tendency could not develop until the very worst case. And to add this, in case the very worst case happens nevertheless, which is also possible, you know, that one really is the most brutal and strong and maybe even intelligent and, you know, marketing-oriented egoist, that in the end then he dominates everything in a totalitarian way. And with his marketing system, he even succeeds in convincing the people that he is a good guy, even though he is a totalitarian totally terrorist. Of course, this worst case, I could not promise that it won't happen. But if it will happen, it's the state. So you can say that the monopoly of law, or you can say the devil, the state always, you know, shows you in order to defend, to justify his own monopoly, this devil is himself.
Well, he owns the schools, so it makes it easy for him.
Yeah. It's better to have only a certain danger for the worst case than the worst case.
The worst case situation is that we will get something like what we have today.
Yes. From the system, I think this is the worst case, what this centralized totalitarianism is concerned.
David, may I ask you, did you enjoy this year's conference in Bodrum, Property and Freedom Society?
That was nice. It was a bit smaller than last year because a lot of people were afraid about this special political situation in Turkey.
Yes. Can you tell us any highlight during the conference that you enjoyed to listen to?
What was very nice, I think, was the lecture of Rahim Takitzadegan. He developed, you know, the idea of university and the traditional historic idea of university that did not learn the people what the truth is, but that tried to be to learn them to be interested and thinking about the world and trying to understand the world. So that was very nice. I like that very much. And I like Rahim very much. He's a good guy. Once I asked him whether he is a anarchist or an anarchist, and then he said, I want to understand the world. But later on, he admitted that this means anarchism.
Yes. Yeah, he's a very nice guy, Rahim. I think we will put up a link to his speech as well. Yeah, I think it was on the rise and fall of the university. And we will also, of course, put up links to your two previous speeches from 2015 and this year as well, so our listeners can listen to more in detail about your private law society and taking the state to court, because I think your speech was one of the most interesting. I think it was about 1 hour, so it was a bit longer than the other one.
It was right after lunch, so I had to try that people do not, you know, sleep during my speech. But I think I was quite successful to prevent from dropping in.
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic. So I think everyone managed to stay awake.
Yeah, very good. Okay.
Do you have any more questions, Joachim, or anything more you would like to say, David?
You asked me about books.
Yes. Anything you would like to recommend?
But I think it's a very nice small book. Actually, there are two parts that were published already from Hans Hermann Hoppe, A Short History of Man. It's a small book. It's about 130 pages, and a real compound. As the title is, A Short History, how human society developed, and namely then the role the state played in this evolution. Very good and, you know, very clear and not very politically correct, but I think very true. So I would recommend that. A Short History of Man by Hans Hermann Hoppe. I always recommend Charles Darwin, The Origin of Species, which is a completely unpolitical book. maybe that's again the other side of our subject, but just to mention the book at least, completely unpolitical, but between the lines, very, very political and very much on this line of consequent thinking and ultimately, I would say, of anarchism.
Very interesting.
And a third book, also from a subject that is not really in the center what we discussed now, is it's called Good Natured, Franz de Waal. This is a primatologist. He, a scientist who deals with behavior of our closest relatives, chimpanzees and gorillas. And wonderful to look at us as, you know, parts of nature, of societal beings that behave quite precisely like those relatives of us. And I think this too gives us a broader view and maybe ultimately then the ability to think more consequently about what all these subjects are.
We will make note of those recommendations.
Wonderful.
It was a pleasure talking with you. And it's a long way, you know, to try to change maybe mainly thinking about these questions, but then, of course, also all these political structures. But it's worthwhile to think about and to discuss it and to maybe to show it to many people.
Well, it's a fun thing to do. It's an interesting intellectual thing to do, if nothing else.
Yeah. At the very least, that's true, yes.
Well, thank you so much, David and Joachim.
Thank you, David. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you, Klaus and Joachim.
And we will keep an eye on your upcoming lawsuit and see how that develops.
I will keep you informed, and maybe next time I can report of new developments, I hope.
Yes, we will definitely have you on again to talk about that. That would be very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.